Our speaker today is Steve Basin from Region 6 in EPA in Dallas, Texas. Steve is actually an on-scene coordinator there and is a member of the EPA Region 6 Emergency Readiness Team. He received his BS in Emergency Administration and Disaster Planning from the University of North Texas in 1990 and joined EPA in 1987. He's the Chemical Emergency Preparedness Prevention Coordinator, and his work experience includes enforcement responsibility of the Community Right to Know provisions under EPCRA and the release reporting provisions of CERCLA. He is the state LEPC coordinator for Region 6 and is also the coordinator for the Region 6 Regional Response Team. Also, as an OSC, Steve has been involved with emergency response and removal activities to assist state and local officials during emergency situations. So with that introduction, I'd like to turn it over to Steve, and just one last reminder to keep your phone lines on mute, pressing star 6. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Jean.
Go ahead.
We're going to go ahead and get started. We have a lot to cover in a little less than 2 hours. I promise y'all to get you out of here by 2 o'clock, so we will move as fast as we can. I want to make sure everybody is on slide number 4, which is session objectives. That's where we'll get started. So please move forward to, at the bottom, it may say 1-4 on your slide. The session objectives itself is obviously to try to provide people that have never worked with mission assignments before but may be going out to the field to work with FEMA staff. They may have to go work at a joint field office or the regional response coordination center that FEMA has, or they may just be going out with their own region working under a mission assignment and would like to know a little bit more about the mission assignment process and how it works, what's covered under mission assignments and what's not covered under mission assignments. So hopefully we'll get through all that in less than 2 hours. So if you'll move to the next slide, slide 5, what is a mission assignment? And what we always like to make sure everybody understands up front, a mission assignment is not a contract between FEMA and EPA. It does not go through attorneys, and it's also not an interagency agreement. This is simply a work order that is issued by FEMA to another federal agency, directing that federal agency to complete a specific task. And that may be working with orphan containers, household hazardous waste, emergency response for EPA or whatever. But they can task just about any other federal agency under the National Response Framework under a mission assignment. And under the National Response Framework, I also have to point out, it says that FEMA can task these other agencies with or without funding. Now, we have not ever seen that where they did that. In our region, at least, they have always provided us funding to do whatever task that they've given us under a mission assignment. But obviously what a mission assignment is established to do is to provide assistance to the state and locals because they are overwhelmed by whatever the emergency was and they need assistance. It's not to provide federal government support just because the state doesn't want to do the work. They have to be able to show that they need the assistance from the federal government. And as we build on this, one of the things I point out is there's three ways that the government provides assistance to state and locals. And then there's three types of funding, and there's also three types of mission assignments. So we go 3-3-3. The first one is the three types of assistance that the federal government can provide to the state and locals. The first one that FEMA can do after an emergency or after a presidential declaration is individual assistance. And this is where the federal government provides individuals that were impacted by the emergency directly. And this could be rental assistance, food, medical care, temporary housing, shelters, all those different things that you see on the news. That's under the individual assistance program. The second one is the public assistance program. And this is where the state has said and the locals have said, we're going to do the work ourselves, but we need financial assistance because it's going to overwhelm us in terms of the financial. And so they can actually apply to FEMA under project worksheets and do the work themselves and get paid a reimbursement from FEMA. And obviously those can be under a cost share or 100% depending on what the president decides. The third one, which is what we're going to talk about today, is the mission assignment program. And this is again where the federal government is tasked by FEMA. You know, they give it to another federal agency to do the work to support the state and locals. So if you'll move to the next slide, which is slide 6, why are mission assignments issued? Again, as I said earlier, it's to help a state with their request to meet their needs that they're not able to be able to do it themselves. And I keep on stressing over and over again to our own region, this is not a situation where the state just says, we don't want to do it, or we have other priorities or whatever. They have to be able to show FEMA that this emergency overwhelms them and that they need the assistance. And the benefit, obviously, of a mission assignment, it's a whole lot quicker than trying to do the project worksheets under the public assistance program. And it also gives them some expertise in the field for the state and locals through the federal government itself. Now, if you'll go to slide number 7, again, there are three accounts that you might see under a mission assignment. So I want to walk through these very quickly. The first one is an emergency itself. And this is where, and as you see on the slide, any occasion or instance where the federal assistance is needed to support the state. In our situation, in our region, a lot of times that's before, you know, during a hurricane situation. And this emergency declaration by the president can be before the emergency actually occurs or right after the emergency. So there may be a situation that they know there's going to be something big hitting the state. The governor will request through FEMA to the president to declare an emergency situation. And if the president determines that there is sufficient evidence, they can declare an emergency. And by doing that, that opens up the emergency fund for FEMA to issue mission assignments. So that's the first type of funding that we may receive. After the emergency hits, whether it's a hurricane where, you know, you had an advance warning, or maybe an earthquake where you didn't get advance warning but it was so severe, the state can go to the president through FEMA and ask for a presidential declaration for a disaster. And we'll talk about that in a second. But right now on the emergency, the thing to look at is those emergencies, they have to submit them within 5 days of the incident actually occurring for it to be eligible, and unless there's an extension, and sometimes they can give them up to 30 days to do that. The other thing I will point out is all of this is under the Disaster Relief Act of 1950, and since that is, you know, 1950, so basically we're on 48 years, there's been approximately 3,300 times that the president declared an emergency situation somewhere in the United States. And I think our Region 6 sometimes leads the whole group of all of them. But anyway, so we have the emergency. If you'll turn to the next slide, which is slide number 8, you'll see characteristics of an emergency. Again, this is where the president, based on the state's request, has determined that this emergency is beyond the state and locals' capabilities to handle it. We're supplementing their emergency assistance. So this, again, can be very short-term stuff, medical care, housing, sheltering, food, generators, water, ice, those types of things. Normally, in emergency, there is a cap of $5 million that the government is supposed to spend during that emergency situation. Now, I will tell you, since Katrina and Gustav and Ike, that has kind of gone by the wayside. They've issued a lot more than $5 million, but they have to get approval to do that through Congress. And again, as I said, they must submit that request within 5 days. If you'll go to the next slide, slide number 9, the next step in this, after the emergency, if the state then says this was such a large event, an earthquake, a major hurricane, whatever, that it is way overwhelming our state and local capabilities to provide assistance to our public or fix things ourselves, then they can request the president issue a presidential disaster declaration. And this goes beyond the emergency to provide even more assistance to the state and local. And again, it's any natural catastrophe or anything else where it's, again, beyond the emergency capabilities. The state must submit this request through FEMA to the president within 30 days of the event happening and ask for the federal assistance. Again, the Disaster Relief Act is what covers this from in 1950, and since that occurred in the last 48 years, the president has declared a major disaster approximately 1,800 times. And the thing I was pointing out this morning, one of the very strange coincidences is one of the last major ones that he did for us was obviously Hurricane Ike. Well, the very first one was issued by Dwight Eisenhower, whose nickname was Ike also. So we have a great tie to the very first one. All right, if you'll go to the next slide, which will be slide 10, characteristics of a major disaster. Again, it's following up on the emergency declaration, so it's beyond the state and local capabilities. It's supplementing what the state and locals can do, and also they have to look at insurance. If the public or the municipals have insurance, it's above and beyond that. What other disaster relief organizations can provide, so it's giving assistance above and beyond all those different things. And there are certain things that the governor has to be able to show that they have done in anticipation and in response to the emergency, but that it's still above their capabilities to do that. And so now we have the two funding sources that another federal agency such as EPA might receive a mission assignment under. And so it's the emergency or the presidential disaster. The third one, and I don't have a slide for it because it's pretty simple, but it's called the surge account. And all that is before the emergency occurs, FEMA may decide to go ahead and activate the different ESFs, or they call them other federal agencies, to simply deploy, like to the FEMA regional center, or to the joint field office, but they already have one opened up even before the emergency. And so that third account would simply be called a surge account. Those surge accounts are supposed to be very, very short term. They usually only last 3 to 5 days, because at that point, normally the emergency hits, whether it's the hurricane or whatever, and at that point they then get the emergency declaration and the funding switches to that. Or if it is such of a large magnitude, such as like Katrina was, they went straight from the surge directly to a presidential disaster declaration. So we didn't even receive any emergency funding mission assignments. It went straight from the surge to the presidential disaster within a couple of days. All right. If you'll skip to the next slide, slide 11. This is not an important thing for us, but it is for FEMA, and it's called the incident period. When the event occurs, FEMA will sit down with the state, and before a declaration is done by the president, they have to sign what is called a FEMA state agreement, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But part of that one item of it is that they have to say when the incident period occurred, and it can be as short as 1 day if it's a tornado, or an ice storm might be a couple of days. A hurricane can tend to, the incident period may last a little bit longer because depending on, when the tropical storm winds, for example, hit ahead of time to when they finally finish. But it is important because there are certain factors that play into what FEMA can pay out and what they can't pay out during that incident period. So the states obviously want it to be a longer period so that more things are eligible under that assistance. All right, if you go to slide number 12, the authorities to issue mission assignments. The first one is obviously the Act itself, the Robert T. Stafford Act. It lays out the groundwork of mission assignment. Just like EPA, how we will have a law and then we have regulations to back up that and make it more specific. FEMA does too. They're under 44 CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations, and that defines what a mission assignment is, what type of assistance FEMA can give out, and when they can give it out, the time periods, and everything else. So, if you're interested, you can go to the actual Code of Federal Regulations, Title 44. The next one is NIMS, the National Incident Management System. FEMA gave that out, issued that out a few years ago. We're all supposed to be following NIMS. We're all supposed to be NIMS compliant. And so if you're providing assistance to state and locals, or if they're receiving assistance from the federal government, they're supposed to be able to show that they are NIMS compliant. And then, of course, obviously the last one is the National Response Framework, which replaced the National Response Plan last year, which in turn replaced the Federal Response Plan quite a few years ago. But that is also the framework which we follow, the base plan and then the ESF. I think somebody hasn't muted their phone. If you'd mute your phone, please. All right. Moving on to the next slide, just quickly, slide 13, how the process works, then go on to slide 14. This is kind of a time chart that will give you an idea of the activities that go on for a mission assignment. There are three phases to issuing a mission assignment. Phase one is the actual issuance of it. Phase two is the execution of it and tracking and monitoring of it. And then phase three is the billing and reimbursement. normally the people out in the field, the OSCs, the RSCs, things like that, we're not interested that much in the third phase, the billing and closeout, but your financial people obviously are. And so your financial section chief and financial group will be working under that part of it also. Now, if you look at the incident itself, some of the phase one, the pre-mission assignment activities can actually, again, go before the incident occurs. So if, for example, FEMA wants to deploy us out to their response center or maybe to work on some of their teams, such as a RNA, the Rapid Needs Assessment Team, or their what they call their ERT-A teams, which is their emergency response teams, they can deploy us to those teams before the incident actually occurs if there's pre-warning, such as a hurricane. Now, obviously, for a tornado or like we had the shuttle a few years ago or things like that, there's no pre-warning, so all this would be after the incident itself. All right, if you'll go to the next slide. Again, we've already covered that a little bit, that the three major types of assistance that FEMA will provide, mission assignments, the public assistance, the individual assistance, and there's actually a fourth category. It's not as a big thing, and we really don't get involved with that, the hazard mitigation program, where FEMA, after an incident, can provide grants to the state and local governments to try to prevent it from happening in the future, and that may be helping to build levees or dams or things like that. All right, if you'll go to the next slide, slide 16. Mission assignments versus interagency agreements. The whole idea is that a mission assignment, FEMA can issue that out rapidly to us. They can get that to you within an hour once you're deployed, once you've been activated. An interagency agreement obviously takes longer because it has to run through the whole system and through the different contracts people and everything else. So FEMA is obviously much bigger on the mission assignment process to be able to get the work order to the federal agencies and start the work. However, as we learned during Katrina, there are times that we know it's going to take a long time to complete the work, and we've been out there in New Orleans for 3 years now. At some point, FEMA will ask to switch the mission assignments to an interagency agreement if it's going to be a long-term process. But quite honestly, you don't really want to do that if you can. It's a lot easier to try to get the work done faster and just stay under a mission assignment process. All right, if you'll switch to slide 17, the next slide, where did mission assignments come from? Years ago, obviously, the states were complaining about that there were such emergencies occurring that it overwhelmed the state's ability to handle them, that they didn't have the funding themselves. Sometimes they actually said, too, that they didn't have the expertise to handle it, that they were overwhelmed in terms of writing contracts for debris removal, providing resources to the locals to understand the myriad of federal programs that might be out there that they could apply to, you know, whether it's under the Small Business Administration or HUD or all the different agencies. So they were asking for federal resources just to help the individuals understand it. And then also the mission assignments were asked to just provide a gap coverage until the federal or the state or the locals could build back well enough that they could handle the situation themselves. Okay? All right, next slide, number 18, activation of the ESFs. When there is an event, if it's ahead of time such as a hurricane or even after an incident, the first thing that will happen is FEMA will activate the agencies. And depending on how big the event is, they may only activate a few agencies ahead of time, or they may activate all of them if they think it's going to be a catastrophe. But a lot of times in our region, for example, if they think it's going to be something small, like a tropical storm or something, they may only activate the Corps of Engineers under ESF-3, Health and Human Services under ESF-8, the search and rescue teams under ESF-9. But it has to be a little bigger before they normally activate us under ESF-10 for the hazardous materials and oil spills response. But if they are going to activate you, the procedure normally in most regions is that the FEMA operations section will call your 24-hour emergency hotline for EPA, and whoever the OSC is answering the phone should get the call first that says, we are activating ESF-10 for this upcoming emergency or one that just happened. And they will follow that up with an activation letter that spells out what the activation is and how long they expect it to be for. That activation letter and the call should work its way to your ESF-10 lead in your region. And most of the time, that's your removal manager in the Superfund program. Now, that activation, again, is verbal. They should follow up with it within 24 hours with a written activation. And in our region, a lot of times, they just fax it to us to provide to the ESF-10 care. In that activation letter, they will tell you what they expect for you to do, whether it's to deploy personnel to their regional response center to work with the other ESFs, whether it's to get on some of their advanced teams, or maybe even deploy down to, if they already have a joint field office set up for a prior emergency, they may ask us to go ahead and go to that. So that activation should spell out what they want you to do. But this is simply an activation. They're not asking you to do work at that point. It's just to deploy people to it. And also understand this activation letter is not a mission assignment itself. They will issue a mission assignment to follow up to the activation and provide the money. The activation does not provide the money itself. Okay? All right. Next slide, number 19. Some common terms, and we're not going to go into them a lot right now, but that you'll hear is the ARF, the Action Request Form, the Mission Assignment Form itself, a Mission Assignment Task Order Form, and a Mission Assignment Subtasking Form. And we'll talk about all those as we go through them. Slide 20, Criteria for Mission Assignment Issuance. As we talked about earlier, FEMA has an incident period of when they felt the incident occurred. And what FEMA will do is they will call the first part of the entire process the emergency phase. And this is where we're providing emergency services, emergency protective measures, things like that. At some point in the process, FEMA will then say we're switching to the recovery phase. And it's more important for FEMA in terms of funding than it is for us, because even though they may switch to the recovery phase, certain ESS might still have emergency work that they're doing. So, but the mission assignment issuance is only supposed to be during that emergency response phase. They're not supposed to issue them out during the recovery phase. The second thing is they can only do it for non-permanent work in the area. So, for example, they cannot issue mission assignments for us to do certain things that are permanent in nature. The best that we're allowed to do is to restore something to what it was before the emergency. But it's not. It's supposed to be temporary work. Then it's also supposed to bring in our unique capabilities that we have, whether it's for sampling, air monitoring, household hazardous waste, emergency response, orphan containers, things like that that other agencies cannot provide to them, then that's why they would issue you a mission assignment. They're calling on our agency's resources and our expertise. One of the things that they always have to be very careful about, and for EPA, this has always been a thorn in the side for FEMA and EPA. They're not supposed to issue mission assignments to us if we have existing authority to do that. And obviously under Superfund, we have authority to do a lot of things. And so there's always a debate about whether FEMA should give us mission assignments to do emergency work and response and air monitoring and sampling and things like that. But we do have a policy at FEMA, it's called the MACRIS memo, that actually spells out that FEMA will give us mission assignments to do these different types of work, and so we always lean back on that policy and say FEMA issued the policy that says that they would give that to us. And the last thing, obviously, again, it's supposed to be beyond the state and local's capabilities. All right, next slide, which would be slide 21. This is your quiz early on. A mission assignment is a work order issued by FEMA. No other federal agency can issue a mission assignment. It has to be FEMA alone. Two, another federal agency. FEMA does not issue mission assignments to states. They don't issue it to locals, only to other federal agencies. They also don't issue mission assignments to agencies within the Department of Homeland Security unless it's a specific thing like the Coast Guard can get one under ESF-10. But for search and rescue, they do not issue mission assignments to their own people. That directs completion of a specific task. The mission assignment is supposed to task us to do specific things. They are not supposed to give us a broad mission assignment, saying, EPA, go forth and do good work. It is actually supposed to line out what they're asking for us to do. That mission assignment will also cite the funding that they're giving us, the type of managerial control that we're supposed to put in place, and any other guidance. And we'll show that on a mission assignment form in a minute. The mission assignment is given in anticipation of or response to a declaration of an emergency or a major disaster, which is what we just covered. All right, so if we go to the next slide. All right, remember we said there were three types of assistance that was out there. The major ones, individual assistance, public assistance, and mission assignments. Then we talked about the three types of funding that were out there, surge accounts, the emergency fund, and then the presidential disaster fund. The next three down is the three different types of mission assignments that are out there. And we'll talk about all three of them. The first one is federal operations support. This is where FEMA or another federal agency is asking us to do work for them. Some good examples of that would be if the FEMA needs the Corps of Engineers to provide generators to run other federal agencies' operations out in the field, they would give a mission assignment to the Corps saying, provide these generators to these people. When we were out at Katrina, they gave a mission assignment to the Forest Service to provide additional radios to us because we had so many people out in the field, we did not have enough radios, but the Forest Service had plenty, so they mission assigned them to do that. And so there's different things that FEMA can ask other federal agencies to do to support either them or other federal agencies. Because this is federal to federal, it's always at 100% federally funded. There's never a cost share to the state or locals for this type of mission assignment. And this mission assignment can be before or after. If FEMA deploys you on that activation that I talked about earlier, that would be a federal operating support because FEMA is asking another federal agency to support them at their response center or at the joint field office or whatever. Okay, so again, those are always going to be 100%. If we go to the next slide, technical assistance. This is where the state or locals have requested a federal agency provide them technical support. Because we're not supposed to be doing actual hands-on work, this is technical assistance, it's always at 100% federally funded also. There's never a cost share with the state. And the way FEMA explains it, if you see it there, it says brain power equals clean hands. So we're not actually supposed to be doing work out in the field. Some examples that we can give you is, for example, they could ask the state could ask the Corps of Engineers to provide them assistance with reviewing contracts for debris removal. Or they may ask EPA to provide assistance in looking at household hazardous waste programs and how best to set them up. Now, we have been able to stretch it in a couple of emergency situations where we also use the technical assistance to go out and do water and wastewater assessments under the Corps of Engineers or even directly to us, where we would go out and just simply assess the condition of the water treatment facility. We're not doing any rebuilding. We're not doing any construction or anything else, but just simply assisting the state in trying to determine the condition of their water treatment facilities. And that's what we're doing right now with Gustav and Ike, is providing the state that assessment. All right, go to the next slide, which will be slide 24. This is normally the big one. This is where they ask the state or locals say, we need help from another federal agency to actually do the work. And so this is called direct federal assistance. And this is where the state and the locals are asking for assistance beyond their capability. It's going to be post-declaration, obviously, because it's work that you're doing as a result of the emergency or the disaster. It's requested by the state. And that's important. All of these requests have to go through the state to get to FEMA. And this one, because it is doing the actual work, is subject to a cost share. And that cost share can go from anywhere from zero. The president decides to leave it at 100% federal if it's such a disaster. Or they can go down to 75%, 25%, where the state has to provide 25% of the cost. Or they can go in between and do a 90-10. Where the federal government picks up 90% of the cost and the state picks up 10%. And that's just based on the argument that the state can make to the federal government of of how overwhelming this is and how much resources that they have. All right. When they are doing this, when they are going to issue out a direct federal assistance, before they do that, the state must agree to some certain conditions for the federal government. One of them is that we are to be held harmless for our activities. So that way that, you know, whatever we do, as long as we're following our own procedures and our own contracts, the state or locals can't turn around and sue us for our activities. And there are some other things. For example, the state agrees to provide us whatever land use that we may need to do our job. So if we're going to go out and do orphan container removal and we need to set up a pad, the state agrees that they'll find us the space to do that so that we don't have to go out and contract on our own. All of this, these type of assurances are spelled out in what they call the FEMA state agreement, and it's signed before they will actually start issuing out direct federal assistance mission assignments. Right? All right, next one. Next slide, which is slide number 25. We're kind of backtracking just a little bit, but the pre-mission assignment activities, so we have the three different types, the federal operating support, the technical assistance, and the direct federal assistance. Before they issue those mission assignments, the first thing is, again, the activation of the ESF, whether it's 10 or 8 or whatever, 7, to let us know that we might get a mission assignment. FEMA actually has to establish a budget so that they know how much money they're going to be spending. They have to go and ask for reimbursable authority, you know, to spend that extra money. The same thing with EPA. If we receive a mission assignment and FEMA says, okay, we're giving you a work order and we're giving you $500,000 for do that, EPA has to go and get reimbursable authority to do that work because that's not in our normal budget to do that. There's also delegations of authority. If you go and look at your delegations of authority within your own region, you'll see that the authority to accept mission assignments has been delegated down to your ESF 10 lead. And again, that'll normally be your removal manager. And so if you're not going to send them to the JFO, if you're going to send an OSC or a section chief or a team leader, then whoever is your ESF 10 should issue a delegation of authority, and it can be simple as an email saying, I'm designating this person to be my representative at the JFO to receive those mission assignments. Obviously, FEMA also has to lay out to the state what the cost share may be, you know, and what for whatever period of time, and that's in the presidential declaration, but it can be either 0, 10, or 25% itself, and then again, the state agreement itself. All right, go to the next slide, slide 26. Now, there are all sorts of different people that can request assistance under a mission assignment. It can be an Indian tribe, it can be the state, it can be a local, it can be a voluntary organization. Even a private sector can submit a request. Now, normally, the private sector, FEMA is going to turn it down because they're supposed to take care of themselves. But all these other ones, the tribal, the local, and everything else, or another state agency, they can request assistance under a direct federal assistance mission assignment. But all of those have to filter through to the state, and normally it's through their emergency operating center, and so they'll receive that request from the local or the other state agency and then pass that on up to FEMA. And that'll go to the FEMA operations section. And so, depending on the emergency and how confusing it can be, you know, every once in a while we'll get a request straight from like our Texas Commission on Environmental Quality or LDEQ, the Louisiana, you know, EPA version of EPA. We cannot accept direct requests from them. It has to go through the state EOC and work its way up through FEMA. All right, go to the next slide, slide 27. The way that request is asked for is through what we call an ARF, an action request form. That is what the state will fill out or the local agency, and they ask specifically for assistance. And they have to be pretty specific about what they're asking for. That ARF will then be sent, like I said, through to the state EOC. And that way, the state emergency management signs off on it and says, we're okay with asking for this assistance. Because especially if there's going to be a cost share involved, they want to know what they're signing up for. Once that ARF is signed by the state emergency management officer, It then goes to FEMA, to their FEMA operations section, usually either at the regional center or at the joint field office if it's been opened up. And the FEMA operations people will log in that action request form, and then they'll forward it to their operations section chief to review it and approve it if FEMA wants to approve that request for assistance. Now, every once in a while, there'll be a verbal request because it is such an emergency situation and the state may not even be ready to be signing these ARFs and sending them up. That is okay, but they have to follow up in writing within a day or two. They can't just leave it as a verbal. All right, go to the next slide, slide 28, and we just talked about that they have to be in writing. They can do them verbally, but they have to finish them up in writing. Go to the next slide, which is slide 29. This is the top part of an ARF, the action request form. The first part of it is the requester's name. Who's requesting the information? And again, it can be a local or state or tribe, or if it's going to be one of those federal operating support mission assignments, it could be another federal agency asking for the support itself, their title, their phone number, what organization they're with, their fax number and email. The second part is, what are they requesting? And that's where they spell it out. And it can be simple as, you know, provide generators to the joint field office, or, you know, go out and do emergency response to, you know, to orphan containers or chemical spills and oil spills. And so it's usually not real specific on this, but enough to at least give us an idea of what they're asking for. Then they'll ask for quantity. Normally we just put one each there. You know, that's it. We're providing the assistance. The priority. For us, it's normally going to be high. You do not put life-saving down because life-saving is pretty well reserved for search and rescue, things like that. And it's not really life-saving sustaining. That's more for food, water, generators, things like that that the public needs to be able to survive. So normally they'll be marked as high for hazardous materials and oil spills. When is this assistance needed? So they put the date and time. Where is it supposed to be delivered to? Well, really what you're going to put up there at the front is the joint field office or the FEMA regional center to the person that's your ESF representative there, who that point of contact is, which will be your ESF representative there, and their phone number. And then if you notice at number 9, the state approving official signature. Again, this has to go through the state if it's a direct federal assistance or a technical assistance one where the state's asking for it. You should click on that action request form. All right, if you go to the next slide, slide number 30, this is where FEMA will sign off on it. Their operations section chief has signed, their logistical section chief, on down, and then whether they're going to act on it or not. And you see on the bottom right it says action request to which ESF. It should, for us, it'll say ESF 10. And understand something, and we'll cover this in a minute. Just because somebody fills out one of these action request forms doesn't necessarily mean it's going to result in a mission assignment. There are other ways that it can be handled, too, and so we'll talk about those in a second. If you'll go to the next slide, sections 4 and 5, this is where you'll put who the action officer is for EPA that's going to be working on this. And, again, it can be the person at the JFO, or you may want to put, like, your incident commander, if you already have one out in the field, their information. Who the FEMA project officer is, because FEMA, for every mission assignment, will assign a project officer that you can work with if you have any questions on it. The justification or statement of work, if you're going to more specifically spell out what they're going to do, then you put that in the statement of work. The estimated completion date, when do you think you're actually going to finish the work that's being requested by this mission assignment? And then the cost estimate, how much do you think the mission assignment ought to be issued for? How much money is it going to cost? And FEMA should come talk to you to determine what that potential amount of money is, so that way they don't short you at the beginning and you have to continually go back and ask for amendments. So if you can, try to get them to work with you on that cost estimate. And then obviously the bottom section is, again, did FEMA approve it or reject it, and how are they going to handle it? All right, if you go to the next slide, developing a statement of work. A lot of times when the state or locals request the assistance from you, all they're going to do is just put something generic. We want EPA to help us on household hazardous waste or orphan containers, do air monitoring, whatever. And they're not going to get real specific about it. So what FEMA will do a lot of times is ask you to help develop a statement of work which more specifically outlines what you're going to do under that mission assignment. And we have statement of works that we've developed for the different hurricanes that we have, and we just simply attach those to the ARC and we run them through the state agency, whether it's DEQ or whatever, so that they're okay with that statement of work too. That way it better explains out what we're all going to do. And that statement of work can better explain the different actions you may be doing under that mission assignment and how long it's going to take for those different ones to be done. All right, next slide, which is slide 33. Again, as I said just a minute ago, just because FEMA receives an action request form doesn't mean that they may necessarily issue out a mission assignment. When FEMA gets it, the first thing they've got to determine is, can they handle it themselves? Because a lot of these requests may be just for goods. Somebody will say, well, we need a generator, or we need a pod set up with food set up for, you know, returning evacuees. Well, FEMA will give that to their own logistics section a lot of times to handle those type of things, instead of giving it to another federal agency. And they may be able to do it under a procurement card, or they may have their own assets to do that. If FEMA cannot do it internally, then they'll pass it on back to the operations group. And at that point, then, they can either do it under public assistance, like we talked about earlier, for the long-term work. They can give it to us under a mission assignment. Or there are some instances where FEMA will say, you know what, your agency should be able to handle this under your own authority. And I know that they have done this before, like with the Coast Guard, where there was assistance requested to look at navigation buoys, and they said, no, that's under your own authority. You have your own funding to do that. They've also done that to the Natural Resource Conservation Service, where they had some canals that were clogged up, and they said, no, you have your own authority and funding to do that. So there are times where they may just turn back to the agency and say, go do it yourself. But if they decide to issue the mission assignment, that's where we go from there. So go to slide 34. Once FEMA has decided, once FEMA has decided that it should go through a mission assignment process, they have some certain things that they have to look at. Number one, is this eligible under the Stafford Act? There are certain things that are not eligible to be covered under the Stafford Act itself, and you just have to go through and look at those themselves. But what is eligible under the Stafford Act is saving lives, protecting property, protecting health and safety, or lessening or averting the threat of a catastrophe. So any of those, if this mission assignment fits in one of those four categories, then it meets the eligibility under the Stafford Act. The second thing is, again, is it beyond the state and local capabilities? The state can't request assistance just simply because they don't want to do the work themselves. They have to be able to show that they are not capable of doing the work, and that doesn't mean all 100% of it, but you know that they're asking for assistance to finish the work itself. Again, they cannot do permanent restoration under the Stafford Act, so they have to look and make sure they're not doing that. They have to, again, look and make sure that we don't have our own federal authority to do the work that they're asking for. They have to make sure that whoever's requesting the assistance is allowed to ask for it. A lot of times they'll receive requests from, again, private entities, or even though somebody may say that they're a nonprofit group, it turns out that they actually are for-profit, and so FEMA can't provide them the assistance. So they have to check on who's actually requesting it. They have to make sure that the request makes sense itself. It is amazing over the 20 years the different requests that we've seen come in that people have asked for that just simply didn't make sense. And the worst one we received one time was asking FEMA whether they would provide massage therapists or not to help relieve stress for people. So it's amazing what they will receive. Again, if it's a request for technical assistance or direct federal assistance, either one, it has to be signed off by the state approving official, who normally will be somebody out of the state emergency management. All right, go to the next slide. And that's slide number 35. Once FEMA, the first person, the reviewer, decides, okay, it's a good mission assignment, we're going to clear it, then it goes to the branch director. And the branch director, a lot of times, is assigned to be the project officer who will work with the ESF on developing the mission assignment and working through the process itself. And obviously from our side, we have to have an action officer, somebody that FEMA knows to go to if there's any questions about getting the mission assignment done, if there needs to be more money added to it, if the extension, if the completion date needs to be extended. So we have to provide them with a person for the project officer to work with. All right, go to the next slide. Now, after Katrina and some of the other disasters, FEMA decided to work with the other federal agencies to develop pre-scripted mission assignments. And the idea was that especially if a region was not familiar with developing mission assignments or working with FEMA, that the language between the different regions tended to be just all over the map on in terms of what they were asking for. And so FEMA worked with all the other federal agencies to develop these pre-scripted ones. And there's actually a catalog of those pre-scripted mission assignments that you can get, and it lists out the ones for EPA. Most of them are for deployment, but there are a couple for technical assistance and a couple for direct federal assistance. But what I would recommend to you is obviously work with your own FEMA region and determine what's best for you. You're not required to use those pre-scripted, but they are a good resource of helping to develop the language in a mission assignment if your region has not done it before. All right, next slide, which is slide number 37. Once FEMA decides to issue the mission assignment, again, it's reviewed by the operations section chief there. It'll be signed by the mission assignment coordinator for FEMA. It'll be signed by the project officer, again, the state coordinating officer if it's a technical assistance or a direct federal assistance. The federal approving official, who sometimes will be the actual federal coordinating officer or maybe his deputy, and then the comptroller, who says there's money available. Now, one of the things I will warn you about is always make sure that the mission assignment is fully funded. A lot of times FEMA will print out a draft one and hand it to you, and if you're not careful, you'll think that it's a fully funded one and think that you've already got the money and you can go forth, and it's not. And I'll show you in a minute how you know whether it's fully funded or not. But and the other things to look for is, again, the cost share and things like that. So, what I will suggest is, and unfortunately I did not put a slide on the mission assignment itself, I apologize, but what I will tell you is at the very bottom of a mission assignment, when you look at it, there is an obligation box over on the right-hand side, and what you want to look for is for it to have the initial IFMIS, and what that's basically the code that FEMA stamps on there that says that the mission assignment has been fully funded. So until that stamp is on there, it's not been fully funded itself. All right. If you'll go to the next slide, which is slide 38. Now, once FEMA issues you the mission assignment, and the best way that I, and the next thing that they'll do is sometimes issue you out task orders underneath that. And what the task orders are doing is better defining or giving you more specifics on what they expect you to do. And the way that I always try to explain it is, when they give you a mission assignment, they will give you an amount of money. And just make it easy, let's say it's $1 million under that mission assignment. Basically, what they have now done is opened up a checking account for you. Then they will start issuing you out task orders if they need to more specifically define what to do under that mission assignment. Those task orders are checks, more or less, writing against that mission assignment. So, for example, if FEMA gave you a mission assignment and said, go out and do orphan drum containers, removal and disposal in the impacted area. Well, that's pretty broad. And they may say, well, we'll give you $1 million to do that. Then they might start issuing you actual task orders that say, okay, go to this county and do it in that county. Do the orphan container recovery. And we estimate that it's going to cost you $100,000 to do that. And I know these numbers are kind of off, so don't worry about the numbers. What they're basically saying at that point is, we're going to let you write a check of $100,000 up against that mission assignment, the $1 million, to go do specifically that work. The whole idea on that is that way it's easier for us to track what we're doing specifically by underneath that mission assignment. That way we also don't get carried away and go forth and do work in every county that may have been declared because they may not have been impacted. Just to give you an example, that Hurricane Ike that just hit the Gulf Coast, there were 29 counties that were declared under the presidential disaster. Well, there's only about 10 of them that we're actually going to do work in, you know, or if that many. But so the task orders better defines which counties that they expect you to do work or that the state expects you to do work. If you go to the next slide, which is slide 39, this is a task order form. Up at the top, whoever's asking for that task, and it'll normally either be the state or the federal, you know, FEMA itself, they'll put what the mission assignment number is, so it's tying it to that mission number, and then they'll give it a task number too, usually like JFO for Joint Field Office dash 100 or whatever. They'll tell you when it's that that task is to be started, who the requester is, and then they'll fill out just a description of the task itself. And a lot of times what they'll do is simply say, refer to your statement of work underneath the mission assignment to be done in this specific area or, you know, for this specific task itself underneath that mission assignment. All right, if you'll go to the next slide, the bottom of that mission assignment task order form, again, FEMA will sign it saying we're tasking you this. This one you actually sign also saying we've received this task order, we've agreed to do it, and in it they'll say potentially how much it's going to cost and what our completion date is. The whole idea on this task order is an estimate. So if they say, well, we think it's going to cost you $100,000 to do this task, you're okay if you spend $110,000 or $120,000. Nobody's going to come back against you. But what this also does is it provides you an opportunity to kind of keep up with where you're at on your mission assignment. Because, again, the mission assignment is the checking account. You do not want to overdraw that checking account. That's a bad thing. That's when you get in to start talking about potential ratifications and stuff. So you do not want to go over your ceiling of your mission assignment. So the task orders are one way of at least keeping track of what you've received and how much you're spending on and whether you need to go back and ask for more money under the mission assignment ceiling itself. All right, go to the next slide, which is slide 41. Execution of the mission assignment itself. When FEMA issues out this mission assignment, they're going to give it to a primary agency. So like for us, obviously for ESF-10, it's going to come to EPA. And understand the way that works under ESF-10. If the emergency was only shoreline or coastal or water, then the lead agency is the Coast Guard. If it's simply inland and there's no coastal effect, then EPA is the lead for it and basically the only primary agency. If it affects both of them like a hurricane will, EPA is still the lead agency. So normally FEMA will issue the mission assignment to that lead agency, so it'd be EPA. But if part of the mission assignment says go out and respond to oil spills along the coast or offshore oil wells, we don't do that. The Coast Guard does that. So what we can do is subtask them underneath the mission assignment and say, Coast Guard, we want you to go do that particular part of the work. Or we may ask another federal agency to assist us in our response. In the past, we've asked DOI to come in and help do environmental assessments. We've subtasked them under our mission assignment to do that. And so we're allowed to do that itself. And those subtaskings, there's a form that you fill out for that. It makes it a lot easier to go through and do those because you can specifically tell that other federal agency what work you want them to do, and you can give them an estimate of how much you think they'll spend on that. So it's a lot easier to do that. Now, on the mission assignment execution itself, FEMA will give you a completion date that they expect you to be done with that mission assignment. And depending on a lot of political and different various things, that can go anywhere from, you know, they may give it to you for 2 weeks up to a month to 2 months or whatever. All mission assignments are supposed to be completed within 60 days of being issued. Now, depending on the disaster, a lot of times that does not happen or anywhere close to it. The regional administrator from FEMA can then extend it out up to 6 months. So basically the longest that they're supposed to extend them out is 180 days. If you go beyond that, they're then supposed to convert them to the interagency agreements and track them on a long-term basis. And that's what we did with Katrina. We ended up converting them. Now, there were some people, some agencies, that even though they went over the 180 days, it was so close that they were going to be finished that they left them as mission assignments. But if you know it's going to be a long period, then you go to an interagency agreement. All right, if you'll go to the next slide, the tracking and monitoring. This is where your financial people are very much kick into it, doing tracking and monitoring of the money itself. Again, as I said, it's supposed to be done within 60 days, but it can be carried out to 180 days itself. Go to the next slide, stand down and deactivation. Once you're done, FEMA will stand down your ESF and say, okay, you're now finished. And so you can go back to your home office or whatever. Now, the stand down that is not completing the entire mission assignment. And the best way to explain this is when they stand you down, it means go back to your home office. But if we need you again, we have not deactivated you, so we can bring you back without a new activation letter. So it's almost like a temporary stoppage of work. But if you're completely done, you can go ahead and ask them to deactivate you at some point also. And that's another letter, just like that activation letter at the beginning. There's a deactivation letter that says, okay, we are now finished with your agency and you're no longer expected to do work. Alright, once we've done that, the stand down or the deactivation, FEMA will ask for a long-term contact. It's normally somebody in your financial section. So when we start submitting bills for reimbursement, that they can talk to about the bills themselves and any questions they may have. And they're also supposed to conduct an exit interview. Quite honestly, we don't do that very much in our region. They'll usually have one with everybody at, you know, the last day, almost like a hot wash. But the idea is that FEMA gets an idea of how much money was spent by each ESF, property was purchased that may have to be returned to FEMA, any lessons learned, any complaints that you have about the process on down the line. They're supposed to do that. If you'll go to the next slide, which is the billing and reimbursement closeout. If you have a mission assignment, you bill FEMA at the end of it on all the different bills that you can bill. If you subtask somebody, the way that works is, let's say we subtask DOI to do work for us. They will submit to us a closeout of all the work they did. We're supposed to review that and make sure it's okay under our mission assignment, but then that agency will bill FEMA directly for the work they've done. That money for paying that subtask will come out of our mission assignment then, because you've asked them to work under your mission assignment, so FEMA will take it out of that mission assignment. But you don't have to worry about paying the agency or anything. FEMA does that. And then any money that's left over on the mission assignment, let's say FEMA gave you a mission assignment for $2 million. You only spent $1 million on it.
Just a reminder to keep your phone lines on mute. If you haven't done so already, press *6 to mute your phone lines. Thank you.
Thanks, Jean. But whatever money is left, they will actually say mission assignment to de-obligate that additional funding. And if there was a cost share of the 25% or 10%, after all the bills are come in and FEMA has reimbursed the federal agency their amount, then they will turn around and bill the state for their portion of the cost share. Please mute your line, please. All right, next slide. I'm sorry, but somebody needs to mute their line, please. All right, let's go ahead and go on. We should be on slide 45, mission assignment amendments. If you need to amend your mission assignment, there are three times that will happen. The first one is the time itself. When FEMA, like I said, when they issue a mission assignment, they'll put a completion date on that. If you know you're going to go past that completion date and still have work to do, they will amend it to stretch out or extend that completion date. So you need to give them a new completion date. And the way you do this is obviously you fill out one of those action request forms, and it comes straight from EPA to FEMA saying, please amend the mission assignment to extend the completion date. The second one is for funding. Either You're asking for more money because what they gave you was not enough to complete the task, and toward the, you know, as you went along, you figured out you needed more money. Or at the end of it, if you've determined that you didn't spend all that they gave you, you can, again, ask them to de-obligate the rest of it. And then the third one is project officer. That's the FEMA person. So if FEMA changes the project officer, you know, for whatever reason, that person quits or is no longer involved in the emergency, then they will amend the mission assignment to tell you who the new project officer to work with. You cannot amend a mission assignment to change the statement of work. So that's why you need to be careful to make your mission assignments, if you can, as broad as possible, or in your statement of work, include as many of the things that you think you're going to be doing, providing assistance to the state, because you cannot add to that statement of work. If there's new elements of a statement of work, you have to issue a new mission assignment. So it's better to try to take care of all of it at one time. And I will tell you, and I hate to admit this because things just got way out of hand with Ike and Gustav. Before it was said and done, we've ended up with like 26 mission assignments between the two disasters, and not laying blame at anybody's feet or anything else, but we need to do a better job on that. And because what we had worked out in our region was that we were going to get 3 mission assignments from FEMA in any emergency. The federal operating support, which would have been to activate and be on their, you know, their support teams, support the PIO at the GFO, you know, all these different things. The second one was going to be a general technical assistance, provide technical assistance to the state, including water and wastewater. And then the third one was going to be a direct federal assistance and have the statement of work of all the different things that we were going to do. So that's what you ought to shoot for in your region, is to have 3. Try to keep it down to 3. Now, there are certain things that they may ask you specifically that you'll have to do a separate one just because it's not covered under your statement of work. All right. Next slide, mission assignment management. Again, we've covered that pretty much. If you amend it, it's to obligate or deobligate new money, extend the completion date, change the project officer. The task orders underneath that are additional directions, you know, that are covered by your statement of work, or to break down costs. You have to issue a new mission assignment if there's a change to the statement of work itself. Next slide, which is slide number 47, accountable property. FEMA has become a lot, and I guess the best word is stricter about this, after the last few big hurricanes and disasters that they've had. They ended up buying like 900 porta potties and 500 chainsaws, you know, in 05 between Katrina and all the other hurricanes. And they quite honestly didn't want all those. But so, because what happens is, under a mission assignment, if it's allowed to buy, you know, supplies or equipment, which it is, if it's considered accountable property, and you can talk to management about what accountable property is, but in our region, especially anything that they put an EPA sticker on with the barcode is considered accountable. Well, if you need to purchase that to be out in the field, whether it's PDAs or cameras or cell phones or radios, if you purchase that using, you know, and you're going to ask for FEMA reimbursement, at the end of the disaster, all that equipment has to go back to FEMA because they bought it. Now, if your agency wants to keep the equipment, that's fine. You just have to pay for it. You just don't bill FEMA back for it. You can use your own Superfund or EPM funds or whatever. But if you use FEMA funds for it and you ask for reimbursement, it has to be turned back into FEMA. What they are trying to push for, and I can't blame them for this, is there may be things that agencies go out and buy that they may already have in stock. You know, for example, a printer or a plotter or a camera or whatever. So the rule is, at least in our region now, and I think it is for most regions, before you go out and buy that accountable property, you're supposed to check with the FEMA office to see if they can provide you that equipment before you go out and purchase it. And it's not a very hard process. We've got a person at the JFO. Come buy anything like that, we send them an email, walk it over to the logistics person, and say, no, we can't provide it. Then we send it back and say, okay, go forth and buy it. But every once in a while, there may be a piece of property that they may say, you know what, we already have one of those, we'll just ship it. So you are required now to go through FEMA just before you buy what they consider accountable property. Okay. Next slide. Exceptions to mission assignments. There are certain things, again, that they don't issue mission assignments for. ESF-5, which is their own internal emergency management, FEMA runs that, so they don't do it. ESF-9, same thing. FEMA is the lead on that, so they don't mission assign themselves. NDMS, the National Disaster, Federal Occupational Support. The last one, which is something that you've got to be careful about, is every once in a while somebody will want to do a long-term study of the disaster. FEMA does not cover that under mission assignments. The Stafford Act does not allow mission assignments to do studies. So just keep that in mind. All right, next slide, which is slide 49. What are considered reimbursable costs under mission assignments? And this is where we have to be the most careful about what is eligible and what is not eligible. The things that are permanent federal agency personnel, and that is their wages. And so, for example, if you're a Superfund employee, FEMA will pay for all your wages, regular salary and overtime. If you're, and I guess that would also cover if you're under the Oil Pollution Act Fund or the Luck Fund. They will not cover comp time. They only reimburse back for overtime. If you are not under a trust fund, if you're an EPM, you know, funded employee at EPA, they only cover overtime costs. Okay? They will also then cover your travel and per diem. If you hire temporary employees to help with the disaster, they will pay their wages, travel, overtime, and per diem. And then obviously if you bring in your contractor, STAR members, they'll pay for their cost. Now one of the things, and I'll give you an example, what you need to do is obviously work very closely with the FEMA operations people on what they'll cover and what they won't, because as you work through it, certain things that they will cover. I'll give you a great example. During our hurricanes, the last three, we have used the Aspect plane extensively to go flying over facilities to make sure that there's not chemical leaks, or, you know, try to find where there may have been spills or anything else. That is beyond what normally Aspect is used for. And if you don't know, Aspect's an airplane that has a lot of specialized equipment on it. Well, because it is used so much during these hurricanes, they have to replace certain equipment and do a lot of maintenance on it. FEMA has agreed that it is okay to pay for that because it is above and beyond the normal use of that plane. So something like that they will cover. They won't cover for you to do maintenance on things that you would normally have to do it anyway. So, like if your contractor takes a truck out there and the second day they say, oh, well, it needs an oil change, they're not going to cover that. So, all right, going to the next slide. Non-reimbursable costs. Again, this is the top one is the most closest one that FEMA looks at all the time, but to this point they've still paid for it. Work performed by an agency under their own authority. Now, again, I have seen them kick out some things by the Coast Guard and other agencies, but to this point, they have always funded the work that EPA did because of that MACRS memo. The second thing, repairs to other federal agency facilities. FEMA will not use Stafford Act money to pay for repairing, like if, let's say General Service, GSA, had a building that was impacted by a tornado, not use Stafford Act money to repair that facility. That has to go through their own agency and you know, if they have to work through GSA or whoever. Litigation costs. If your agency is sued because of work that you did, FEMA will, you cannot use Stafford Act money to help with the litigation costs. One of the things that we found out by this also that you need to be careful of, FEMA does not, they also will not pay for cost of doing FOIAs. That is considered to be just something that your agency is supposed to do anyway. So if you have a large disaster and, for example, pull a whole lot of sampling data, and somebody decides to FOIA you that on, you cannot turn around and charge them for the time that START or ERS takes to pull that data out for you for a FOIA. The EPA has to swallow that themselves. Again, something that's non-reimbursable is the full-time salaries and benefits for non-trust funds. So again, EPM employees will not pay for their regular costs. They will, again, pay for their overtime. Unsupported claims and excessive unreasonable costs. I'll leave y'all, let everybody decide what that would be, what are unreasonable costs, and amounts exceeding the funding authority. So again, like I said earlier, if they give you a mission assignment for $1 million and you blow over that and spend $1.5 million, FEMA will not reimburse that other $500,000. So you've got to be very careful that you don't exceed your mission assignment amount. All right. I keep on mentioning ACRIS memo. If you'll go to the next slide, slide 51, this was written up in, I believe, 1999, and then it was again approved in 2001. It is actually, if you want to read it itself, if you'll Google FEMA and then the word MACRIS, M-A-K-R-I-S, you'll actually see where it says ESF-10 policy, and you can click on that. And this is the policy that was written up. It was signed by Jim MACRIS originally and a person at FEMA, Lacey Souter, but it actually has become a FEMA policy. And in it, it spells out what FEMA will pay and what they will not pay for under ESF-10. So if your region, the FEMA people start giving you any hassles about, well, you should be doing this under your own authority, bring out that policy to them and show them what it says. So these last few slides is that. Activities EPA will fund. We will pay, FEMA will not, but we will pay for any activities at an NPL Superfund site if it's a pre-existing site. So, for example, during Ike and Gustav, we had a lot of NPL sites that were in the path of the hurricane. So what we've done is send out remedial project managers, RPMs, after the fact to check on the status of those sites and see if there was any damage done. FEMA will not pay for that because those are existing NPL sites, so we're having to pay for that under Superfund. They also will not pay for activities that we have to take after a disaster at an existing OPA, oil pollution site. So like if you've got abandoned oil wells that you're cleaning up, or if you've got an abandoned refinery that you're cleaning up under OPA, if a disaster hits that, FEMA will not pay for any of that work. So they feel like that definitely is under your own authority and you've already got funding to do that. Next slide. What FEMA will pay for under the Stafford Act to EPA or to ESF-10. Staffing of pre-deployment teams. So again, going to their regional operations center, going out on their emergency response teams, going out on their rapid needs assessment teams, all those different things FEMA will pay for. Retrieving and disposing of orphan tanks and drums. That's covered. Household hazardous waste program expenditures, so the collection, the bulking of it, the disposal of it. If you're helping a community run a household hazardous waste program, they're going to do all the collection. You're just helping them run a pad or dispose of it. That's covered. If you want to help put out flyers on how to do household hazardous waste, how to segregate it from other construction debris, that's all covered. Go to the next slide. Technical assistance to the state, and mostly what we do again in our region under technical assistance is provide going out and doing water and wastewater assessments to see if they're operating or non-operating or if they're not even, if you can't reach them. That's covered. And some of these are just kind of weird ones they do, and they're pumping of water out of basements where there's hazardous materials. We don't have a lot of basements in our region, but obviously if you had homes that were contaminated with hazardous materials, you can pump the water out. That's covered. Initial assessments to determine if there's a health and safety need. So basically going out and doing emergency response activities, that's covered. Go to the next slide, to slide 54. This is pretty much our emergency response program in a nutshell. Control and stabilization of releases of hazardous material oil and cleanup of the hazardous materials and oil. So even though we obviously have authority to do that under CERCLA and OPA, they have said that as a policy, if it's a result of a natural disaster, then they will go ahead and cover that. Okay. The next slide, monitoring of immediate health threats. Media applies to threat when it may not, whenever it may occur. Obviously for that, what we've been doing is like air monitoring for emergency responders to make sure that the ambient air is safe. We also have done some air monitoring when they were doing demolitions to make sure, or not air monitoring, but sampling, to make sure that whether there was any asbestos being released during the demolition project that the county or what may have been undertaking.
Didn't want to overwhelm.
All right. Last couple of slides. Pay for cleanup of removal of hazardous materials or oil in buildings or facilities otherwise eligible for FEMA assistance. In other words, public buildings. Normally, FEMA will not pay for you to go clean up a private company, even though they've had a spill or something as a result of a natural disaster. Now, I will tell you that that can be bent a little bit. We've had emergency situations during the hurricane where we knew that incompatible materials were mixing together, and if something wasn't done immediately, that they were going to have a lot bigger emergency than what they had, and there was no responsible party, there was nobody from the company anywhere around because they'd been evacuated, at which point FEMA went ahead and allowed us to go take care of that emergency, even though it was in a private property. I also know that during Katrina, another example was there was a meat locker down in downtown New Orleans that had 500,000 pounds of meat in it with no refrigeration. Normally, FEMA would have said that's the owner's problem, but because there was nobody around, FEMA went ahead and tasked the Corps of Engineers to go clean up that meat locker before it became a public health threat, which, to me, that just makes some common sense. So, all right, next slide. Now, this is one of those ones that FEMA will not fund under the Stafford Act. They will not pay for testing of soil, air, water, mold, whatever, if you're going to use that testing to determine long-term recovery activities or remediation activities. They do not pay for that. So again, what you have to make the argument is that you're doing air monitoring or sampling to protect the emergency responders that are there, you know, in an emergency situation, or just making sure it's not a hazard to the people returning back to their homes. But you cannot, they will not pay for it if it's to determine if there's a remediation action that needs to be taken. Okay? Last slide on this. Other things that FEMA will not pay for, permanent storage of hazardous materials. They will not pay for you to set up your own RCRA site and maintain the materials. They do expect us to dispose of it properly. Cleaning or replacement equipment that is damaged during long-term cleanup activities. Again, if it's an emergency situation, and let's say you've got a multi-ray out there and, you know, for whatever reason it gets damaged because it's being overused, that they will cover, but they won't cover it if it looks like it's a long-term remediation activity. And they will not pay for the state or local cost for long-term cleanup measures also. Again, the Stafford Act is there to pay for emergency situations. That's it. That's all the slides. So at this point, what we'll do is open it up to questions.
Steve? This is Jean, and I'm just going to start with the questions that were submitted online. Again, the online participants can use that question mark icon to pop open our question submission form and complete that, and I'll read the questions off on your behalf. So we just have one that came in online right now, and then after that we turn things over to the phone line people. This comes in from Washington, D.C., and the statement is, I understand that some agencies charge overhead on mission assignments. Do you know why EPA does not? And in parentheses, someone who now works at EPA in OXFO, who used to work at FEMA, asked me. I didn't know that other agencies charged. He said as much as 35% overhead, but that might not be an accurate value.
My understanding is, yes, is that like the Corps of Engineers does charge for overtime, and that has been a question that's come up many times for EPA, and quite honestly, the answer has always been, we just don't do that. I don't know. I'm sorry, but I don't know if there's a better answer than that, that EPA just by policy in the past has not done that, or by practice.
Okay, great. Thank you. For those of you, while we're waiting to see if we get any more questions online, if you're joining us by phone, you can feel free to take your phone off of mute. If you've muted it earlier, you can hit R6 to unmute.
Hello?
Yes, feel free.
Yeah, how are you? I have a question regarding slide number 26.
Okay.
You may have answered it with the meat locker situation, but you mentioned in these under we're talking about who can request federal. You've got under state government, you've got private sector businesses. And when you went over this, you said usually that's not the case, but you have it listed here. But
well, understand what that slide is for, and it may be out of sequence to make sense. What that is those are all the different types of entities that can request any type of federal assistance after a disaster. And remember, because I was talking about, just because they request it doesn't mean that it'll go to a mission assignment. It may be that FEMA takes care of it themselves, or they may ask another agency to deal with it under their own, you know, their own authority. Well, one of those opportunities is if a company or a business is affected by the emergency, they can go to the Small Business Administration and ask for either grants or loans from the SBA. So that would be where that, it wouldn't be a mission assignment, but it would be kicked over to them to look at for potential grants or loans.
So in essence, this could be like a small operation in terms of a clearinghouse. They can request it. They may not get FEMA assistance, but there's something else out there that would be helpful.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Sadarate from Region 4. I've got a question for the same slide. I guess it's slide 26.
Okay.
Okay. The we are talking about the ARFs, right? The all those entities up there have to put a request through the state. Am I correct?
Yes.
That includes the tribal governments.
Yes.
Because I do coordinate tribes here, and they don't get along with the states well, and they think, you know, they are their own self entities.
Right.
Have you ever had any experience with them as to, you know, if something happens in the tribal land, and then let's say an emergency, how that one will work?
Well, and I have to be very, very careful about speaking in terms of FEMA and their programs, but normally, FEMA looks at a tribal entity. If it's a federally recognized tribe, they basically look at it as almost like another state agency. And so that federally recognized Indian tribe still has to go through the state to request that assistance. Now in our region, like for example in Louisiana, there has been one tribe that was affected by the hurricane that is not a federally recognized tribe. And so what FEMA has said is they can apply for assistance just like a local entity, or even their own individual citizens can apply for individual assistance. But they still look at them as part of the state structure. And whether that's right or wrong, that's the way they do it. And you're right. I mean, we've actually had one tribe that basically said they weren't going to ask for any assistance because they did not want to have to go through the state to do that. And so that's going to be something that FEMA is going to have to work out internally themselves.
Okay, well, we're waiting to see if there are any other questions. There were some that came in online. One comes in from Atlanta, Georgia, and they ask if you'd please go over the answers to the questions on slide 1-21.
Going back. Okay. What we said was a mission assignment is a work order issued by FEMA. And again, they're the only agency that can issue a mission assignment to another federal agency. They can't issue it to a state and local. It has to be another federal agency that directs completion of a specific task or job or assignment. It cites the funding that they're going to give to that federal agency, any managerial controls of how that works to be done, and any other guidance to that mission assignment, and it's given in anticipation of or response to a presidential declaration.
Okay, great. Are there any other questions for those of you left on the phone lines? Feel free to take your phone off and mute and just speak up. Had a couple of positive comments come in online for people who just wanted to say thank you for a good training.
Thank you. We got them out early.
Okay, great. Well, if I don't see any additional questions coming in online at this point, and I don't hear anybody else speaking up on the phone lines to ask Steve any final questions before we close out, I'll direct everybody to slide number 60, which is the last slide for today's presentation. And you'll find two very important links on that slide. The first one is the link to additional resources, where we've collected a few things that are relevant to today's topic, as well as opportunities to download the PowerPoint presentation and sign up for future training opportunities that we offer this way. And the second link is the feedback form. It's just a short little questionnaire to let us know what you thought of this training and how it went off for you. And we do appreciate those of you who take a moment or two to actually fill it out, because we do read it and review it. If you want, when you fill out that feedback form, you'll have the opportunity to have a confirmation email sent to you, so you have that as a record for your completion of this training class. For those of you who are sharing the phone line, you can each take turns and fill out that completion form and each get your own confirmation email as well, if you'd like. I just wanted to express my gratitude and thanks to Steve from Region 6 for offering this training session today, as well as the OSE Readiness Training Program for helping to sponsor it. And I'd like to thank all of you guys for joining us both online as well as on the phone. Again, my name is Jean Down. I'm with the Technology Innovation Program, and I'd welcome any future comments or questions. I hope to see you guys on another delivery that we offer here on Cluin. Thanks, and I hope you guys all have a great day.
Thanks.